The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On today's show, I'm joined in the studio by the film critic Jason Solomons and editor-at-large of the art newspaper Jane Morris for a whip-around of the week's film releases and art exhibitions. Plus, we'll meet the artist Celia Hempton in Rome and we'll have this week's global countdown. Stay tuned. Jason and Jane, welcome to the studio. Now, we're going to begin at the cinema with Wonder Wheel. This is the latest film from Woody Allen, starring Justin Timberlake, Kate Winslet, Juno Temple, and Jim Belushi. Jason, fill us in on the storyline first of Wonder Wheel.
Set in 1950s Coney Island, a place that's very familiar to Woody Allen fans. You might remember in Annie Hall, his flashback to his childhood. He grows up in the middle of a roller coaster in that house, hence his nervous disposition, he always says. Well, this is a film sort of almost to go back to that family who grow up in this house.
The house, of course, doesn't really exist. Sorry to disappoint.
It doesn't anymore, but it did. There was a house in the a hotel in the Coney Island roller coaster.
Is that right?
It was actually there.
That's quite extraordinary. It seems so ridiculous in the film.
I know, and then it got completely. Eventually, it was up till about 2010, and then it got sort of dilapidated and sold off. So now it's all.
How sad! I must have just missed it with my trip.
You could have gone. So it really was there. So this isn't as fantastical as all of that. So it is about a frustrated actress called Ginny, who instead of being an actress anymore, now works on in a clam chowder house on the Coney Island boardwalk. All is not well with her, and all is even worse with her. When her stepdaughter from her marriage, Juno Temple, Carolina, turns up on the run from a mobster husband. Meanwhile, Ginny has fallen in love with a handsome lifeguard by day, off-Broadway playwright by night. You know the sort.
Oh, gosh, they're everywhere, aren't they?
Played by Justin Timberlake. And she's having an affair with him against the wishes, obviously, of her husband, Jim Belushi. Except now Carolina has come along, a damsel in a one-suit bikini, and she has now taken the of Justin Timberlake, and all sorts of melodrama and close living ensues.
A complex set of affairs, to say the least. Let's hear a clip first.
Enter Carolina.
Excuse me, do you know if Jenny's here?
I'm Ginny.
I'm Humpty's daughter. Here's his wife.
Is he gonna be surprised?
I'm marked. They're gonna kill me.
That's what you get when you marry a gangster.
I gotta have a drink.
No, Humpty, you've been good.
Damn it!
Miss, you can't be out here right now. We're expecting lightning storms.
When you're married to a man who got rich putting people's feet in cement, you probably never had to do a dish.
Your wife don't like to go fishing anymore, Humpty.
She made like she liked it. To get me on the hook, I was the fish.
Jason, the style of this film is somewhat interesting, but perhaps for Woody Allen fans, not so much. There have been other films that are of his that have taken this style, but it's got a bit of a documentary feel.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I suppose it's because he grew up not far from there in a film called Radio Days, which he made in the mid-80s. That was more of a sort of his memoir of his childhood. And that almost sort of had a wistful kind of documentary feel to it. This is, I would say, hyperlit by Vittorio Storaro, the cinematographer with whom he's been collaborating recently and who shot Apocalypse Now, for example. And he bathes this all in a kind of golden light, an impossible light, and a slight neon light from the kind of funfair that's always going off with firecrackers and shots from the rifle arcade and kind of neon signs that flash things like, you know, milk for 1 cent. It's kind of an extraordinary kind of looking film. One of his most beautiful looking films, although the sentiments contained therein are rather ugly and sad, if not brutal.
Now, it's impossible to, somewhat sadly, impossible to assess a Woody Allen film in today's age without considering the context in which this film is being released. And no doubt the film will be hurt by a lot of the discussion that has been going on about Woody Allen and those allegations that have been raised again against him by people within his family. Tell me, how do you feel about that? Being someone who yourself is a film critic, who has always been a long devotee of Woody Allen's work on the screen, you've even written a book and another a second version of your book is about to come out about Woody Allen's films. How do you go to one of these films knowing what you know from the news headlines?
Yeah, well, I always knew these things, you know, ever since I was a sort of a grown-up. I knew Woody Allen had disappointed millions, including myself, when he kind of went off with Sun Yi, and that was a bit of a shock when he went off with Sun Yi and left Mia Farrow, and she was her adopted daughter from another marriage. But nevertheless, Woody had known her for many years, and that was always odd. Then there were the allegations during the custody hearing that he had abused his own 7-year-old daughter, Dylan, which never went to court. It was never prosecuted, and he was sort of cleared of that. And that kind of disappeared for a while, although it was always there to anyone with the kind of access to a Google search machine or the New York Library of Public Records.
Absolutely. It was only a few years ago that Woody Allen himself wrote a very long piece for the New York Times that assessed a lot of the allegations that had been levelled against him as well. Yeah. So it's actually been around quite recently as well, and really just erupted yet again when Dylan Farrow brought those allegations back up in the midst of the Me Too movement.
She did do that. And, of course, Ronan Farrow's journalistic stock is at its height because he helped bring down Harvey Weinstein. So everyone's talking about, well, maybe this Ronan Farrow, maybe he's kind of Pulitzer-winning journalist now. Maybe we should listen to what he's saying. When I first wrote the book, I thought, do I delve into this? And then I did delve into it, and I thought, God, this is getting dark very quickly. It's a very nasty family business. I don't know what's true and what isn't. Moses Farrow, their son from the same relationship, says that poor Dylan's making it all up and that she's very bruised by the whole experience and that Mia brainwashed them. So I don't know who to believe in all of this. And I don't really want to defend Woody Allen if it's the case. What I want to defend is his work as an artist, which is what I was writing about. And I never found anything to put me off doing so, because I think he's always kind of been very hiding in plain sight, if you like. And then I decided, gosh, that my new edition of my book is merely adding to the fog what Dylan Farrow says, enabling Hollywood to sort of say, well, look at these maestros, look at these kind of great men, you're just adding to the kind of climate around them, and sort of saying, well, their work is great, concentrate on the work, and meanwhile they behave like monsters and abusers. I don't believe that Woody is a serial abuser and serial monster. At least he wasn't the 5 times I've met him. He's always been very charming to me, but then that's what they do. So delving into the work is very hard. Yes, it's never really affected the work, I think, until recently, although I think people kind of think that since he's been with Sun Yi, it's tailed off and he's not creating nothing like the masterpieces he did with Diane Keaton and Mia Farrow. People say, oh, his work's so creepy, it's always about old men and young women. Well, I had a look at that as well. He's made 49 films, 6 of them contain age-inappropriate relationships, possibly. So his work isn't always about those things. Again, I don't want to defend people who are offended by the fact that there's an older woman, a younger woman, an older man, and he mines that for comic kind of depth sometimes. So going to this film, I thought, well, you know, what's it like? He's not in this film, so that kind of helps people who think he's too old. But it does visit all his familiar tropes of kind of lost love and memories of the 50s. And, you know, it's old Woody Allen stuff, and people kind of say, I've seen it all before. I would say that since the last Woody Allen film, Café Society, which did quite well at the box office, I've seen maybe 500 films in between the two Woody Allen films, because they always come out a year and there's always 500 films. I've seen not one film like Café Society until I've seen this new one, Wonder Wheel. So 500 other films out there, none of them are like Woody Allen films. He is still a unique artist who makes films like nobody else. So if you like those films, you're only served by that one vision, by that one artistic kind of impression. This one is like a 50s melodrama that he saw on a stage in when he was growing up on Broadway, a Eugene O'Neill or an Arthur Miller, and it's got that feel to it. And no one else is doing films with Coney Island Washboard Roundelay by the Mills Brothers, or Joe Stafford songs, or kind of old-fashioned literary scripts that are elegantly crafted and could do with another draft maybe. But hey, if you're 83, are you going to do a rewrite for anybody? No. So, you know, go and see it if you want to. If you feel creeped out because it's a Woody Allen film and you're kind of contributing to the fog, I totally understand your feelings too.
Look, Wonder Wheel is out in cinemas now. Also available on screen is the Oscar-nominated and Palme d'Or winning film, The Square. Made by Ruben Ostlund, the director behind Force Majeure, this is a satirical look at the art world, starring Elizabeth Moss and Dominic West. Jason, I mean, this one can last year, the Cannes Film Festival last year. Cannes is about to happen again. An awfully long time between drinks here. But tell us all about this film.
Yeah, and you mentioned Force Majeure, his film before that, which won Un Certain Regard, the kind of minor section in Cannes in 2014, which I thought was a better film than The Square. It's superb, Force Majeure. It's ruined skiing for me. I can never go skiing again, which is no great loss to the slopes, I have to say. But it is a wonderful film that's built on a moral conundrum about an avalanche coming towards a dad and his family. And the dad runs away scared, and the avalanche doesn't hit the family. He comes back and kind of goes, oh, right, that's all right. And then the mum says, I think you just ran away, leaving us. And The Square is also predicated on the same sort of moral conundrum. Ruben Östlund, the director, it kind of works on like a Swedish sociologist. They were very famous for this in the 70s, the Swedish. They did lots of experiments. And he does all these social experiments. And The Square is about an art curator played by Claes Bang, an actor I've never heard of who's fabulous, who plays this very kind of cool modern art curator with the glasses and the suit. And he has his mobile phone and wallet stolen in an elaborate kind of sting that's almost a performance piece outside his gallery in a square. He, meanwhile, is launching a new exhibition about a square in which the plaque on the square sort of says, within this square, you are allowed to behave kindly towards people and people will do kindnesses to you and humanity will be observed within the parameters of this square. And it's like, says the director, like traffic lights and traffic and zebra crossings. You know, why do we obey these kind of societal rules? Stop at red and go at green. You know, it takes a lot of work for us to do that, but we could just ignore these rules. The square is like that. So it's a whole film about this and the chaos that his life goes into when he can't find his iPhone and he takes a bit of revenge and his world starts unravelling very gently, very massively, and suddenly by the end he's a complete wreck and this kind of great bourgeois society has got right into this man and is collapsing before our very eyes. This is perfect Ruben Östlund territory. He doesn't play the moral conundrum right, this guy, so therefore he is ruined before our eyes.
Well, before we go any further, let's hear a clip of The Square.
Do you just go have sex with just anybody?
Excuse me?
Do you just go have sex with lots of other women?
Kind of private question, isn't it?
Well, so is being inside me. Pretty private, so.
But where's the connection there?
I'm asking how often you do. How often would you say that you take women that you don't know very well and have sex with them and be inside them?
Do you want me to explain what's going on there? That's Elizabeth
you
Moss.
You can do your best.
She's an art journalist and she's sort of slept with him, having done an interview with him. And now she's confronting him in the gallery. And the noise we can hear behind is this kind of ridiculous installation that Jane will understand in contemporary art of some chairs that are about to teeter over. And they keep wobbling every time they're about to have this kind of climactic conversation that she's confronting him about his sort of sexual mores and his one-night stands. So that's the noise we can hear in the background. And it's sort of, the scene plays out over 5 minutes and this chair keeps happening. This installation keeps happening around them. So there's lots of satire on the art world like that, how it impinges on our real life and how you can't really tell whether it's the satire of the mobile phone unravelling or the actual art world unravelling around him. There's a wonderful scene, which is one of the great scenes in European cinema this decade, of this bourgeois gala where all the kind of grandees of the art world are gathered together to be a benefit for the art, which Jane must have been to constantly. You have loads of dresses for these occasions, I'm sure.
I wouldn't say constantly, because mostly they tend to invite people who are going to give a donation of at least £10,000, but continue.
But a tweet or a bit of coverage wouldn't go amiss. Here we go. So this guy enters, this artist called Oleg, who he's played by an American actor called Terry Notary, who does lots of work in the Planet of the Apes, and he pretends to be this ape, this monkey. You may have seen the poster. He kind of gets up on the tables and starts flinging the silver service around and kind of touching people's hair, and people can't work out if it's funny. Then he starts assaulting kind of one of the ladies, and no one kind of interrupts at all because it's an art piece. And then they realise that he's really taking it too far, and then it all goes, and it's really emblematic of what this film does. And it's a scene that you think, oh God, I don't want to watch this scene. And Ruben Östlund makes it go on for like 11 minutes, and it's like cringeworthy, but absolutely compelling. And that's his whole modus. So sometimes you think, oh, that's a bit smug and Swedish and kind of neat and ironic and cold, but it's also brilliant.
Well, smug and Swedish, is that the sort of the little niche that he's carving out for himself, Ruben Östlund? I mean, he's gone from, I mean, Force Majeure to this, the Palme d'Or winning film. You know, he's gone from strength to strength.
I know, the first Swede in 66 years to win the Palme d'Or, and you'd have thought they're a pretty major filmmaking nation with Bergman, etc. So, yes, and he rather amusingly made a viral video. His film, Force Majeure, didn't get an Oscar nomination, which everyone thought it would, and he made this viral video of him going yelling, letting out this kind of yell well of disappointment that went a bit viral of him not getting an Oscar nomination. Well, he won the, then won the Palme d'Or with this new one, and he got an Oscar nomination the other week for The Square. Didn't win, so I don't know how he's reacted to that. I haven't been online to check. But a lot of this film's about a viral video, because he makes a video to promote the gallery, which goes all a bit wrong. It's sort of supposed to be a cool video by a cool ad agents that he hires, and it goes terribly wrong, and the art gallery are disgusted with the results, but it's tried to be provocative. And I've actually interviewed Austin, and he sort of blames goldsmiths for everything. He sort of says all these theories that goldsmiths have. And there's one scene where there's an art installation of, it's kind of a pile of dunes of mud around, and then someone comes up to him while he's having a conversation with Elizabeth Moss and says, "Excuse me, boss, I think we've got a problem with the cleaners. They've hoovered up one of the piles thinking it was dirt." And it's very, very art world, Jane. You must come across this all the time.
That has actually happened at art fairs. There has been rubbish cleared up that wasn't actually rubbish. And we've had the opposite. We've had critics opining about sort of piles of cardboard left in the middle of squares that turned out not to be a site-specific installation. It is actually all true.
Well, I work in the media, and I'm magnetized when it comes to media world satires. Do you feel the same way, Jane, about art world satires?
I think that I don't think I've seen one that, certainly I'm just thinking about films, but I may have missed something fantastic and I haven't seen this film. I've usually found they've sort of missed the mark, because people are usually a bit too excited in a way by the glamour of the art world. But this one sounds like it might have real potential. Just some of the things you're describing sort of almost happened.
I think actually it has happened. The square, he says it came from an exhibition that he actually did in Värnamo.
Oh, that sounded, the idea sounds totally credible.
Yeah, and now there's three squares in Gothenburg and Värnamo, and people are sort of going about them, and buskers are in them kind of doing things, and people are protesting about benefits for refugees in other parts. And so it sort of has worked, and things have been left that you're supposed to be able to leave your wallet there and it won't be stolen. That's one experiment. And kids have sort of said, yeah, we'll leave our wallet, but I'm not leaving my phone, because I can't live without that, which is a bit ironic, because that's exactly the premise of the film as well. So I think it's a very, very clever film. Perhaps too easy targets with the art world, and perhaps too many ideas in there. But, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, take against the film, because it's got too many ideas. You know, most of them don't have any. So this has hoovered all the others up.
Yeah, that sounds fair enough.
Yeah, you're making me definitely want to go and see it. It sounds like it probably does hit a few marks.
And you'll know most of the people in it. I mean, there's one Dominic West plays a sort of visiting artist who's being feted, and there's a big talk, and there's a member of the audience who's got Tourette's and keeps shouting out rubbish, rubbish, and sort of really putting Dominic West off his stride. And apparently that really did happen a few times. So they're all based in truth, and yeah, they're all part of a sociological experiment. The only problem I have with it is the audience also feels slightly experimented on. I keep thinking that maybe cameras were trained on me, saying how I was reacting to the ape and whether it's getting towards my inner ape.
Well, that's the key to a good satire, isn't it? Being a little bit too real. The Square is out in UK cinemas today, and that brings us nicely on to this week's real-life art exhibitions that Jane Morris is going to talk us through now, starting at the Barbican. For Another Kind of Life, Photography on the Margins. Now, this is a group show that examines work across the 20th and 21st centuries, part of the Barbican's The Art of Change season. Jane, what is the season about, and how does this one fit into it?
Well, I think this one is very much looking at the kind of political ideas of the moment. I mean, particularly ideas, I think, around identity, gender, race, representation. The way it's been done, it's quite interesting. Although it said it's a group show, it's actually 20 individual rooms, and the rooms are mostly the Barbican has built sort of blocks within the space. So it's really like going into 20 mini single person exhibitions. And generally you can see a route through, but you're not really looking at one person's work and then seeing somebody else's work through the doorway. So it's connected, but each artist has been sort of given like a little mini show. So it's a very nice way of showing photography, actually. And the idea, it's presented chronologically, sort of chronologically, and it's trying to trace roots, I think, from probably one of the most famous photographers of people on the margins of society, Diane Arbus, who actually came from a very wealthy family and then became very interested in a different way of living. And it starts with her, and then it works all the way up to artists from very recent. Teresa Margulies is the last photographer in the show. And she's photographing transgender sex workers in Mexico. They apparently worked in a town that was very violent, very dangerous, and full of nightclubs and discos. And the authorities raised them all to the ground. And what she's done is photograph the workers in their finery, because they actually now have no work. So the nightclubs have gone and some of the violence have gone, but a lot of people have lost their jobs. And it's raising some sort of interesting questions about how you deal with these kind of issues. I think it's a very interesting show. It's a very tough show, to be honest. And I think we're all fascinated to some extent by the idea of outsiders. But in this show, I think it raises a lot of questions about what that actually means, because some people have clearly chosen to be on the outside. There's a very interesting set of photos by someone I didn't know, a guy called Alex Soth. And he went in search of people in America who had basically deliberately disappeared into the backwoods and have created their own sort of woodland living on their own. And, you know, they've chosen to do what they're doing, and he goes after them, photographs them. He had to become like them himself. But then there are other people who pretty much didn't choose to be in the situation they're in. There's some very tough photographs of American street kids from the 70s and 80s, and it's absolutely shocking. One of them set by Mary Ellen Mark. Absolutely shocking that such a thing could happen in a rich country like America. So, you know, there's a lot of questions about what is an outsider, whether you chose to live like this.
Do you get an idea for what, I mean, in the title, of course, it's a photography on the margins. And do you get an idea for what the margins actually might be? Because I suppose some of the difficulty might be when you're curating an exhibition like this, really, it seems to be such a potentially massive topic that trying to hone that down to something that can fit inside any sort of cohesive space might be somewhat difficult.
Well, I think that's perhaps why it's been curated the way it's been curated, because you could really say it's 20 different snapshots and it's not trying to make a unified point. I mean, I think it's not trying to make a unified point. I mean, there's some great photographs of teddy boys, you know, in the 1970s, and they're, you know, they're sort of fantastic pieces of British documentary footage. But to me, that's very different than, you know, like the street kids I just described. I think that they do ask a lot of questions about the relationship between the photographer and the viewer and the subjects. I mean, there are actually some things that really did make me think of a film. There's a photographer called Danny Lyon, who you, I'm sure, are aware of, Jason, who joined a gang of bikers in the 60s for 4 years. He could only take these photographs by becoming part of the group. And then very famously, his images were the inspiration for Easy Rider.
Yeah. And I think Dennis Hopper hung out with him for a bit He'd done his own exhibition as well, which was at the Royal Academy at one point as well. It's very interesting hearing you say, because some of the revelatory stories in a documentary sort of way, and some of them seems like the mix of art and news footage, like bringing attention to Mary Ellen Mark, because she's an artist, but some of it seems like street photography, some of it seems like news photography.
Yeah, I mean, there's a set of photographs of transgender, cross-dressing. It's hard to know the right words to use. At the time, people would have described themselves as transvestite, but I now gather that that's not a term people want to use. But there's a stack of photographs that were found that are more like outsider art, in that they were not taken as art photos. They were taken by the group themselves for their own enjoyment, and then become unearthed later, and they're presented as one set of photography, which is, you know, very different from somebody as a professional photographer going and doing reportage. So I think, no, it's an interesting show that raises quite a lot of questions about that relationship. There's an exceptionally uncomfortable set of photographs by Boris Mikhailov. He's a Russian photographer, and he is very interested in how the photographer has manipulated the people he's working with. And he basically asked, I think he paid two homeless people to take place in a sort of fake marriage ceremony that he creates. And you're very aware that he's doing it. And there's something very, very difficult about these photographs, because the people in the photographs, he's very clear what's, you know, what's been done. And the people are looking out at you and they've kind of got this sort of half hopeful, almost happy sort of look. And yet you're very aware that they've been paid and they're being manipulated by this photographer, and we are being manipulated too and complicit in some way. I mean, I think those are some of the strongest works in the show. And I stood for quite a long time in front of those feeling, you know, they make you feel quite dark.
Another kind of life. Photography on the Margins is on at the Barbican until the 27th of May. Now over to the Whitechapel Gallery now for Theatre of the Natural World. This is an exhibition by American artist Mark Dion. Jane, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, I think that this is a completely contrasting show because this is one for the museum nerds amongst us. Mark Dion is somebody who has been fascinated with the way, particularly museums, but also 19th century institutions in general, I would say, classify and organise knowledge. And what he does, he became well known in this country because a few years ago when the Tate Modern was being, the foundations and so forth were being dug of Tate Modern, he did a thing called the Tate Thames Dig. I don't know if you know about this. Basically, he encouraged volunteers to go onto the foreshore, dig up everything they found, and that it was everything from those little clay pipes that used to be everywhere, 200 years ago, to modern day lighters, all sorts of rubbish. And they collected everything and they cleaned everything and then they organised it into beautiful taxonomies, and then they put it into display cases, some of which are on show in this exhibition. And you can pull out a drawer. And it might be full of nicely arranged pottery, or it could be a load of bottle tops, all given exactly the same sort of status. So he's always been interested in what we think is important, what museums think are important. He's also got quite a strong environmental track record. One of the things he's done, which I loved, this is my museum nerd coming out, but there was a fashion some years ago to get rid of those old 19th century dioramas, you know, the ones with the stuffed animals and the painted background, and it would show the lion and there would be a painting of a savannah behind it. Museums felt that these were very, well, very old fashioned, and actually people tend to love them, but not very educational. So they started getting rid of them. Dion has photographed 40 of these of polar bears, and you see different museums around the world and it looks like it's a set of wildlife photographs of the polar bears until you realise they're all stuffed and they're all displayed in different presentations. Some have very naturalistic backgrounds and others there's like birds with them. That's really about the sort of disappearing world. And the fact that sort of Enlightenment knowledge has contributed to the destruction of these animals. But he's more ambiguous than I'm making him sound. He encourages you to kind of look and wonder and have the wonder of the wonder camera.
They're very displayed, aren't they? I mean, yeah. I love an art display case at the best of times. Maybe repurposed in my beautiful Shoreditch loft or something like that, if I was lucky.
But then you'll love this.
But he's got a lot of drawers and pulling out things and cabinets.
Absolutely.
And kind of, so I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Damien Hirst's pharmacy initially, but it's got all this kind of wonders in it. The Horniman's Museum and
exactly.
the Soane's Museum. It's got all of that kind
exactly.
of in there.
And the cases are often authentic cases. There's a new piece for this show, which is it's a great big aviary, a metal sort of cage. It's got real birds inside it. And there's a tree in the middle and there's loads and loads of books piled up against the tree, which is all the study of birds, whether it's, you know, science, atlases showing where they come from, this kind of thing. The birds are very happy in this environment. They're a little kind of finch, which apparently are very comfortable in a gallery space. You look at this and it's funny. It's quite witty. The part of the point is that there's all this huge pile of knowledge around the birds and they've now been given all this knowledge and it means absolutely diddly squat to them. You know, we think we create their world and we don't do anything of
you
the sort.
You say that. They're reading these books thinking, I'm going to bust out of here. We'll go next week, they'll have tunnelled out these finches and they'll be on the loose.
I mean, that would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, the title of the show is Theatre of the Natural World and you do get a bit of a striking impression from that sort of title. Do you think it lives up to the expectation that that's perhaps evoking?
Well, it's a very big title and that, in one sense, I don't think anything could truly live up to that title. And maybe that's part of the point, because I think it's, as I say, it's a commentary on our attempts to order and describe the world. And it does, to some degree, suggest that we are always going to fall short.
I suppose part of the challenge here is that this is at least attempting to say something about the natural world, the world that we live in, that we all inhabit. But there is a surrealist element to this as well. Do you think that those two things speak quite harmoniously to each other?
Yes, I think in that idea of that these imaginings of the world are not as scientific as they might like to, you know, as we might like to think. I think that's one of the points he's trying to make, that we don't have as rational an approach to the world as we think we do, and that our knowledge itself is not as rational as we think it is.
Mark Dion, Theatre of the Natural World is on at the Whitechapel Gallery until the 13th of May. Thank you to Jane Morris. Now, before we have this week's Global Countdown, we're going to stay in the art world, but head to Rome to meet the British artist Celia Hampton. Hampton has just launched a new exhibition at Galleria Larkin O'Neill called Breach. This show contains her pastel paintings, which explore forbidden or potentially dangerous places, whether she's painting from the edge of an active volcano, creating images from hacked surveillance cameras, or painting naked men from internet chat rooms. Monocle's Rome correspondent David Pleasant went along to the show to meet her.
I came to Rome in 2008, oh my God, and studied at, or was at a residency called the British School at Rome from 2008 to 10. And that actually really changed my work completely, because I just graduated from the Royal College of Art, and, you know, however many years of education where you get taught to be super, super critical all the time. And actually, not to undermine in any way Rome, because I find it very conducive to creative work, I felt a sort of lack of criticality to a certain extent, which was a relief and actually made me much more ambitious. And, you know, because you can talk yourself out of things, put yourself in a corner.
Was the aesthetics of the city, the light maybe, was that the more inspiring elements, not the sort of scene? Is that what you mean?
That, for sure. I mean, my work suddenly became like tropical ice cream colours, because every day the light is incredible and the sunsets are beautiful. And I think, apart from anything else, the theatricality and the fact that the sensory qualities of Rome, whether it's just walking down the street and smelling baking, you know, if it's in the summer, then you smell like a dirty bin. And then the roses and the opulence of everything is so extreme. And also bodies are everywhere, naked bodies are everywhere.
Which is what we'll go on to in a little bit. So that's obviously influenced you as well. So you would take that back to Rome, that sort of fascination with nudes and so on.
Yeah, and obviously wall painting. So I made my first wall painting in Rome.
Perhaps it's like over talked about when people look at your work, but there does seem to be an ongoing fascination with nudity, the male body, that kind of thing. Maybe it's a bit facile just to want to focus on that, but it, you know, it's interesting. Can you sort of talk about the history of that element of female gaze? That has been expressed in your work? Maybe introduce us to it and bring us up to speed with some of the pieces that you have at this show.
Okay. When I was studying at art school, I was making paintings of me in often very traditionally male spaces, or spaces that were occupied generally by men. So they might have been industrial spaces of some sort, building sites. And then I made paintings of these kinds of building sites where I kept wanting to put women into them, and then that sort of didn't work in a formal sense. I couldn't figure out how to make a good painting like that. And then the landscapes themselves became bodies when I was at the Royal College. So whether it was like a sewage pipe or something that looked like an anus with like reeds around it, often in outskirts of London, places like that. And then when I came to Rome, I realised, why have I never done it the other way around and treated the body like a landscape in a way, or how I might be in a landscape, or like when I've gone on walks, or because they were always quite kind of performative, I would make paintings on building sites, for example, and there was always like a level of trespass. And I think there's something about an idea of trespass, or looking when I'm not supposed to look, or looking for longer than I get to normally look, you know, at something. So for example, making a large painting of somebody in one day where they're really in front of me, I'm looking at somebody sent genitalia for 8 hours, which you wouldn't really normally do, even if you see it or pay attention, good attention to it during a sexual encounter.
Celia Hampton's exhibition, which is called Breach, is on at the Galleria Lorcan O'Neill in Rome for the rest of the month. Now, to end the show, of course, we have to have this week's Global Countdown, and Fernando joins us in the studio as always. Welcome, Faye.
Hello, everyone. Was enjoying the chat before?
I'm sure you were. Now, we're about to enjoy this, I have no doubt whatsoever, because you're going to count down the music for us. In one corner of the globe, where are we off to?
I think it's time to go back to the Netherlands. From what I can remember, I think it was my first Global Countdown. And it's such a nice market because it's very varied. There's hip-hop, there's even rock and roll as well. It's very hard to find that in the charts these days. Shall we start with number 5, Ben?
Please.
It's a great slice of pop. I think we should listen to a clip of it and then we can talk about it.
Bit of a potty mouth there, Fernando. How do we feel about such overt uses of expletives today?
I kind of don't mind.
You're fairly liberal about that.
I'm very liberal about this. And just so people know, this is American DJ Marshmello with the British singer Anne Marie, and the song's called Friends. And of course, the clip is, you know, there's a house party, everybody's dancing. It's a bit cliche in that sense. But I think it's an efficient beat, you know?
An efficient beat.
Yeah, if I may say this.
And correct spelling as well. So there's the bonus there that you could, your kids can learn to spell Friends, at least, correctly.
Oh, exactly. Friends, of course. Because I was going to say, Marshmallow, it seems, is spelled incorrectly.
Yes, if you can't that's get that right, at least they managed to get the that's true. In the lyrics, correct.
All right, Fernando, let's move on to the fourth place now.
Number 4, we have... I actually called a Dutch friend of mine today because I wanted more information about this band. And apparently they've been like a mainstay of Dutch rock since the early 90s. But they disappeared for a while, but now they're back. I think we should listen to a clip. This is Bluff featuring Heike Arna Ert. En dan zitten we hier in het oude standhuis. Wat je vertelt, had een nuchtere man. Over mijn hoofd zie ik de grijze wolk. Ik ben blij dat je hier bent, blij dat je hier bent. Wij zitten hier in het gammele standhuis. Maakte me toch aan het uithalen.
Fernando, your pronunciation of the artist there was perfection. Can you tell us the name of the track?
Yes, it's called Zoeteland, which is actually the name of a town in the Netherlands. And the video clip was filmed there. It's quite bleak, you know, there's a lot of seagulls. It looks a bit like the British coastal town in a way.
I have actually been there.
You've been to Zoeteland?
Long time ago.
Were you in the video?
No.
No, and I have a funny story about this, Jane, actually, because apparently the tourism in that region is increasing just because of this song. So, because I wouldn't say it's the most touristic place in the Netherlands, but I think people, they decided that, you know, they want to visit because this song has been a while in the charts and it's still there, number 4. And everybody wants to work with this band Bluff at the moment. Even our number 1 song today, which I'm not going to review now, but he wants to, apparently there's a work there between Bluff and the number 1. I'm not going to tell anything else.
Don't tell us anymore, you'll ruin it for him. Let's move along to the 3rd place now. So this is a rather more familiar name.
It's number 1 everywhere. It's number 1 in the US, I think, for about 8 weeks now. It's Drake, God's Plan. Hope I got some brothers that outlive me. They gon' tell the story, shit was different with me. God's plan, God's plan. I hold back, sometimes I won't, yeah. I feel good, sometimes I don't, like, yeah. I finesse down Western Road, like, yes.
Nothing makes me feel like I've aged past the point of top 40 music than hearing a Drake song, I have to be honest.
Yeah, wait until you listen to number 2 and 1. Especially number 1, I have to say.
Fernando, are you surprised that someone like Drake seems to have quite global appeal? Because when I listen to that, it does feel like something that is quite specific to a particular kind of America.
I'm not surprised at all. I think he's the one of the main artists of our time, you know. So, you know, since 2006, like with songs like One Dance and many others. So it's kind of not a surprise. I mean, he's just there. If he releases anything, it's going to be number one in quite a few countries around the world. Well, not in the Netherlands. He's number three there. But if we move on to number two, actually, finally, some Dutch acts. I like local acts, as you know, in their own charts. Is Dutch rapper Josilvio with Catch Up. Let's listen to it. Nu zoek je weer contact, ik was al klaar met jou. Kijk, Shari, je moet weten, ik was echt met jou. Moest overleven in mijn eentje, in die fucked up kou. Je wou verbreken wat we samen hadden opgebouwd. Nu wil je pull up any wine en catch up again. Maar ik ben niet met die lies en bullshit girlfriend. Pull up any wine en catch up again. That's got quite a tropical beachy feel.
Exactly. That's what was written in my notes. There's a Caribbean Dutch sound to it, in a way. I mean, he's a rapper. I think this is a bit kind of more of a suave song. And if you look at the video, everybody's on the beach having fun. Again, it's a cliche, but to be honest, on a rainy day like this, you know.
It's not Suriname, the Dutch colony that had a Caribbean coast.
I think he's got a kind of a Suriname family, but he was born in the Netherlands. But they have quite a strong connection there. You know, a lot of kind of rappers from Surinamese origins as well, and I think Josilvio is one of those as well. The number one, actually, we're talking about this kind of multicultural Netherlands. He was born in the Netherlands, but I think he comes from a family from the Egyptian background, even though his sound is very Caribbean in a way as well.
Where references are all over the place.
Yes, shall we listen to the number one song?
Let's do it. Geschoten in mijn hart, bang bang. Ga je het nemen als ik het voor je breng? Ik weet dat je wil, ik kan het horen aan je stem. Okay, so that doesn't feel as Caribbean, to be honest.
Maybe less Caribbean. What do you guys think here around the table?
I think the Dutch like a Dutch act, which is great news.
Yes, it's a very strong market for local artists, and they like kind of a lot of young artists. I see that as well. For example, this song's by a Dutch rapper called Ronnie Flax, and he's singing with very young. She's only 19. Her name is Funke Louise. She's not only a rapper, but she's also a vlogger.
So vlogger with a V.
Yes, with a V, which means she does videos.
I didn't think that was still a thing.
Apparently, in the Netherlands, it's quite a big thing.
And a clogger.
And a
well done.
Very good. Ka-ching. Yeah. You get the money.
We like some good puns here. And
well, I can tell that Jason has already started adding things to his playlist. I think Jane and I might be in the same boat here. Just scooted right over our heads, Jane.
I don't know. I just think there's something, if you grow up in the era of kind of the Smiths and the Stone Roses, I just think we're never perhaps going to quite go this far.
That's what we have Fernando for, though.
Not even a bit of bluff.
They were a bit soft rock for my taste.
Too
the
soft.
AOR, which wasn't really the thing when I was
too soft
in my prime.
Well, we've got a treat for Jason and Fernando to end the show, but that indeed brings us to the end of today's program. Thanks very much to my guests, Jane Morris and Jason Solomons. The show was produced by Holly Fisher, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco was our researcher. My name is Ben Rylan. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, let's play out with some more of that number one from the Netherlands. This is Fan. Baby, je gaat nergens heen. Alles ga ik met je mee.